From YouthQ, I'm Cindy Sterling. This is QCast. Robert Sterling has just released a new book titled Principles of Choral Arranging. Written from his 4 decades of experience as a professional arranger, the book is accessible enough for the beginner and sophisticated enough for the more experienced arranger. It's a must-read for choral musicians, arrangers, songwriters, and composers alike. In today's episode, Randy and Robert talk about the reasons for writing Principles of Choral Arranging, its features, and how it can help musicians better understand choral treatment in music. It's Tuesday, April 27th, 2021. This is episode 71 of QCast.
Robert, it's good to have you on the other side of the microphone today talking to us. Welcome.
Hey, it's good to be here. I'm really happy to be here with you guys.
Well, good to have you. You know, we're looking at this book that I just received last week, Principles of Choral Arranging, that you have just finished. It's hot off the press. In fact, it's just hot in my hand right now as I'm holding it. And I have just jumped into this book and have thoroughly enjoyed it. And I've read the introduction, which I would definitely suggest the readers do. Sometimes we skip the introduction and we want to get right to it, you know. But I really suggest that we all read that introduction because it is superb. And it kind of puts things in perspective for the rest of the book. So what possessed you, what inspired you to write this wonderful resource?
Actually, it began quite some time ago. As I dug this back out, it became my year of COVID project, you know. But as I dug it out, my first draft, the first introduction in the first couple of chapters had a date of October 2015 on them.
Wow.
So I basically was 5 years later finding the time to really tackle this project. But it was born, much like my songwriting book, was born from teaching for the Gospel Music Association. This book was born from teaching for Joe Martin's Composer Symposium.
Okay.
I've been teaching for that symposium for at least 12 or 14 years or so. Every year in June. And now we've added another one in the fall. And it was all those little basic subjects that I kept seeing new arrangers and young arrangers, and even some arrangers that have been around for a while, making the same mistakes, you know, or having the same questions. And I thought, you know, let's just put something together that addresses all of that in kind of a big picture and in a friendly way.
Right.
And so that's how the book began. But of course, when I began doing it, choirs were singing and publishers were publishing and music was going out. And so it would seem almost the height of folly to write a book about choral arranging principles when choirs aren't meeting and choral print music sales have literally fallen to zero. Not 1%, zero. There are no choral music sales happening. And it would seem silly to write a book about it then, but I am, for a curmudgeon, and I am definitely a curmudgeon, I am still an eternal hopeful person. And I just have hope and confidence that choirs will come back.
Yes.
People have been singing together since the dawn of time. I just think it's in our DNA. We want to sing, don't you? I mean, that's
yeah.
So I thought, surely this the need will come back.
People have been singing together since Mel Brooks' movie, The History of the World, Part One.
Yeah, exactly.
And exactly. So we're thinking that it's going to come back. And I think what you've done is writing this book in the desert, so to speak, is a real expression of faith on your part. And I think that's a beautiful thing, really.
Faith or folly, one of the two.
No, it's faith. It's faith, okay, well, because we're all.
I appreciate that confidence from you. I really do, because there were times when I was working on it that I was going, this is really silly. You know, why am I doing this? But, I had the time and the motivation and thought this is maybe it's ideal. Get it done. So
that's the interesting thing about the way life is sometimes. The only time that we would have the available time to do something is when the circumstances or the exteriors might seem the absolute worst to get it done. And yet when we express faith in the future, faith in God, that this is going to come back, then it then provides that platform, that portal, the opportunity to be able to get this thing out to where when things do come back, it's sitting there ready to go. And,
yes.
You know, Robert, I'm seeing things beginning to, develop back in a different way, of course, and in a very slow fashion. But I do believe that we will be back. The National Cathedral has provided us, given us three requested dates for programs in 2022. So this means they think things are going to come back as well.
That is excellent news. Really excellent.
Yeah.
YouthQ's 2021 Virtual National Honor Choir is accepting director recommendations for older high school students now through June 15th. There are 50 chairs open for the National Honor Choir, and they will be filled on a first-come, first-served basis. If you have a student who should be included in the Virtual Honor Choir, it's important you act quickly. The group is already filling. For more information, go to youthq.org or see the May and June issues of the newsletter. The Virtual National Honor Choir wants to include your top singers.
Well, talk to us a little bit about one of the things I have found the most interesting in the book and most colorful are the little sections in most chapters that it's called In Their Own Words. Mm-hmm. And you quote some of your colleagues.
Right.
I have found that really interesting and really crystallizing for some of the things that you're trying to do.
I use that very same approach in my previous book, The Craft of Christian Songwriting, which I wrote a decade or so ago. But when I did that book, I wanted to have the gravitas, if you want to call it, of other voices other than just mine on this, so that it's not just my opinion about these things. And so I took that same approach here, knowing full well that all these terrific arrangers that answered my questions and offered their input, any one of them could have written this book, honestly. They're all that good, And so I sought out and got about a dozen of my fellow arrangers to respond to some very simple questions of principle, because I wanted this book to stick to principles more than anything else, whether it was about ranges or about how do you pick keys for something, or what's some of your basic principles for writing a piano accompaniment, these kinds of things, and got their answers and then boiled their answers down to a sentence or two. I picked out their main stuff and put those in there. And the purpose of it is to give the reader insight into other people's minds, not just mine. That's one thing. Also, it was very encouraging for me that many of their answers came back and strongly reinforced points that I had already made in my text. They never right. even saw my text. They were just answering the questions honestly. And I was going, see, they are saying the same thing I said in the text. And so I can drop that in and go, see this, here's another professional arranger that reinforces what I'm saying. Because we're, you know, the pros are all working in fairly similar methods. Not, we don't all do everything the same way, but there are right. some basics that we all adhere to. And right. so that was, I thought that was great. Plus, I got some great quotes in there. My personal favorite in the entire book is from Wes Ramsey, a Nashville arranger who does a lot of traditional choral stuff now. But Wes is an old studio pro, too, from years back. And when it came to children's voices, his quote was, children are not short adults. You know, they shouldn't be treated like short adults. So I just loved that. And so, yeah, I think those quotes help keep the book more interesting, easier to read. And those quotes reinforce really important points throughout the book.
Oh, yeah. They were dead on. They were spot on all the way through, very much reinforcing. It's fascinating to me that you were able to use your own compositions as the illustrative material, the right. examples, the musical examples. Would you discuss that a little bit? Well, I found it kind of interesting as to why you did that. And I thought it was good, really good that you worked.
There are several reasons. Some of them, most of them, are very practical. For one thing, I didn't have to seek permission to use my own material.
Big thing.
And these days, even getting a free license to reprint something is a tedious journey. Back to my songwriting book, I had 10 of my own lyrics reprinted in full in that book to use as examples. And even though I wrote every one of them, I still had to get permission to print the ones that had been previously published. And it's just a set of hoops you have to jump through. And don't get me wrong, I'm a copyright owner. I think copyright is great. It's just a lot of trouble sometimes. And so part of it was I could use my own material and not have to seek permission, other than I think there are three or four examples in there that are co-writes that I did with other people. And my friends, Chris Machen and Paul Smith, and those guys were very gracious to say, yes, of course, use that. You know, it's no problem at all. The other reason I used all my own material is that I was very familiar with it, and I could literally go and pick the exact kind of music that I wanted to use to illustrate my point, whatever it might have been at the time. And I'm fortunate enough to have a big enough catalog now and one of enough variety that I could use my music to demonstrate traditional choral arranging as well as contemporary pop choral arranging, traditional piano accompaniments versus rhythm charts and how to write for a rhythm section and that sort of thing. Because I've always kind of had a foot in both of those worlds. Some arrangers stick to one world or the other, the pop world or the traditional high church world. And I've kind of been in both for 40 years.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And that's good for this book. It's not always been a good thing for me professionally because people don't know what to make of what I do as an arranger. Some people literally think of me and think only of Jesus Paid It All, the very traditional choral arrangement I did of that. And other people look at me as an arranger and think only of some, you know, hot praise and worship arrangement I did back in the 1990s for Word or whatever, you know.
Right.
So it's whatever somebody knows me from is how they may respond to my work.
Q Coach with Dr. Jonathan Rogers is now available. This innovative online resource offers you a new way to deliver quality choral instruction directly to individual singers. QCoach is available only to YouthQ members. So, if you haven't already, go to youthq.org and sign up today. After membership, there's a modest cost for every member of your choir to access QCoach. Visit youthq.org for complete information.
This is what I have enjoyed the most about our professional relationship over the past several years, is that you're so versatile, and I'm not just trying to flatter you here, but it's really true.
Oh, go ahead.
You're versatile. Yeah, you like that. It's really true. You're so versatile, from writing theme music for podcasts to theme music for Look at the World, to composing or arranging a wonderful setting of I Sing the Mighty Power of God. Those usages are wonderful in the YouthQ world, and we have certainly appreciated that. One of the things that I want to mention is your whole chapter and your whole dealing with the ideas of ranges and tessitura and texture, all of that. Mm-hmm. This is especially helpful, I believe, for the young choral director and the young minister of music who goes to an inordinate amount of reading sessions and tries to figure out, now, is this a good piece for my choir or my group? And what are the criteria you use to determine that? Now, with enough age, you begin to intuitively figure that out. Mm-hmm. But I remember when I was in my 20s, I was wondering, now, why are my colleagues so excited about this one piece and thumbs down about this piece? And your treatment in this book of these aspects of range, tessitura, texture, all of that, and dynamics as well, because you can't sing fortissimo in the lower register.
Low E flat.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're good. And the more you try to do that, particularly with young voices, you're putting barnacles on their vocal cords, and you have to be very careful about that, especially in the lower range with students. Almost more damaging than in the upper range, you know.
See, I just learned something. I did not know that. Yeah. So thank you.
Well, it can be if you push it and you fry it and you gut it out down low, you're really roughing up those vocal cords. This is really helpful for young choral directors to learn what is proper and what is appropriate for the age groups and for their own groups. So I hope that our young colleagues will get their hands on this book as well.
Thank you. Well, I know that when I was a young teen and my voice was dropping, I wanted to push it down. Boys want to push their voices down, you know, but it really does work your voice. And of course, in pop music now, pop choral music, there is a tendency to push the girls' ranges very low.
Right, right.
Because that's where pop girl singers sing.
Right,
all
right.
In the chest and way down low. And of course, trying to get sopranos to push those notes below a B flat can be very, it's not a pretty sound.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of the pop stuff in recent years, particularly as the duets have become popular, is guys in the stratosphere and the women down low, and you know, maybe at some point they both go in the stratosphere for the climax of the piece. And right. But and it's perfectly okay for the young men that you were talking about to exercise their voice on the low end. That's no problem. But you just have to be careful with the amount of torque that you put into it. As long as it's light and gentle, they'll not hurt themselves with that. It's only when we put the PSI behind it that it really becomes an issue. So one of the things that has been really revealing to me in the book, a word of personal privilege here, I do just enough arranging to be dangerous. I will every now and then, write a song or a theme song for an emphasis we have at church or a liturgical worship theme. And I will do that. I'll write introits. I have several hundred introits, descants, that kind of thing. And this material is helpful for me in all of those ways, but it's also helpful for me as a conductor. I was amazed at how learning this side of it and becoming more familiar with this side of it is going to help me as a director doing average rehearsals with church choir, student choir. And it's also going to help me as a conductor when in front of an orchestra or in front of a choral group or both. Mm-hmm. And so it's just very interesting to have the insight from the other side helps me to have a better big picture view of it.
That is fascinating and surprising and exciting for me to hear. As an arranger, I often think about tempo and expression and all those jobs of the conductor and try to put enough information on the score for the conductor to know how to interpret it. But I have heard my arrangements done by multiple different groups that, and they often sound very different, you know, a lot of different interpretation there. So that's really interesting that you would say that what's in the book is helpful. I am super glad to know that. Just yesterday, I was working on a piece, which I kind of hope to show to you at some point, because it's kind of aimed at, it's on the subject of loss. And I thought this is something that youth choirs have to deal with, but very much the whole afternoon going, what is the right tempo? What is the right expressive word here for a conductor to know instinctively what to do with this? Because it's a very give and take kind of piece. It's not something with a rhythm section that just rocks along, you know? And so I think that's really good for me to hear and to know that there are things here. I mean, the whole tessitura thing, you talked about tessitura and texture and ranges and stuff. Honestly, my approach is a very, let's be realistic. You know, I'm not a great singer. I'm a choir bass singer and, you know, very much a bass singer. If I have to get up above the A at the top of the bass clef, I'm having to start to work. You know, my voice rests real naturally at low G is where my voice just sits, you know, and I've sat in choirs and heard the grumbling, you know, of the basses going, you know, and sometimes they were grumbling about what I wrote, you know, and I'm married to an alto, and boy, altos will let you know when you start writing too high for them.
Right.
One of the problems that the choral publishing world has kind of, the monster that they've created in an effort to sell more music are these really slick demo recordings. Now, demo recordings are, and I talk about demo recordings in the book, because they're kind of a necessary evil. that we have to have, because so few choir directors have time to sit down with a piano, a choral book or a choral score and play through and sing through the parts. You guys have got so much on your plate, and so they need a quick way to listen to something. And so you need a good choral demo. The problem with these choral demos is that there is literally nothing you can put on the page that will stump these session musicians. They can sing anything, they can play anything. And so you really don't know if what you've written is practical if you just measure it against those people. It's all about thinking, what's the real world like? And so that's why I on the ranges, I talk about, well, here's the extreme range of a professional SATB choir. The bass is down to low C's. I've seen that in print.
Sure.
And I've been in choirs that was there and we had to try to nail it. And sopranos up to high C's or even D's, you know, above the treble clef. But in reality, where everybody sounds best is in the staves. I say, keep it in the staves. That's where typical choir sounds the best. And if you've got a smaller choir, I compress that range a little bit more, because the fewer singers you have, unless it's a handpicked group, like you've got a couple of youth cue groups that are auditioned and they're your top notch kids. Well, they may be smaller in numbers, but they're stronger in talent, you know, than the mass groups.
Right.
And so they can tackle things, but your typical small choir out there that has 15 or 20 people also has less talent too. And so those big ranges, but see, those big exciting demo recordings help sell music. And then you put that music in front of your choir at home and suddenly it doesn't sound the same.
That's right.
Right. So, that's all of that about ranges and tessituras and textures and breathing and diction and all that. That's just the practical world of amateur vocalists.
And you know, in addition, the studio session, the post-production after that, if you have a balance problem some way and you just need more low C, well, you just crank it up.
You know,
very different than what we find in our choir lofts, you know, with 18 or 22 volunteer, you know, people with maybe only two tenors.
Right. And sadly, though, if we were to make our demo recordings with 18 or 20 amateur singers in a choir loft, no one would
listen,
would listen to the music.
We've
reached this place where everybody expects to hear a professional recording.
And
I talk about that in the book, about how challenging that is in this time where self-publishing is becoming more of a reality for a lot of people, that the single biggest hurdle to jump is that demo recording, which is so expensive to do. I'm headed to Nashville next month. And one of the main reasons I'm going back, besides visiting my grandkids, is is to do a short choral session with some new material that I've written. And it's expensive. And guess who's paying? And I'm paying for it out of pocket because I self-publish now. Those are the challenges that arrangers are facing these days, you know, from a business standpoint. And from a musical standpoint, they kind of tie in together.
Why not go to youthq.org and register now for your annual membership? When you become a member of YouthQ, you not only gain access to the finest student choir resources available, but you also help provide this great service for your colleagues and friends around the country. Join YouthQ today.
Well, the work that the arrangers and composers do, and the work that the choral director in the church and the in the educational setting, the work that we do, those are inextricably connected.
Right.
And it's just so it's so good to hear the other side of that and to see the innovation and creativity. Now, I want to go back to the very first thing that we talked about. And that is the doing this book during the pandemic or during, you know, out in the desert, sort of the voice crying in the wilderness out there to say, there will be choral music again, and you're gonna need this. The interesting thing about that is that I'm going to kind of go out on the limb here a little bit and say that a lot of really talented would-be composers and arrangers have difficulty in their careers because somehow they lack the discipline that is needed to put your backside in the chair and put your elbows on the desk and your fingers on the keyboard, and to do the work, the hard, lonely work, when yet 'tis day, while the opportunity is there and the window is open. And I would imagine that it just took an incredible amount of self-discipline to get up, you know, in the morning thinking about that book and going to work on it during the pandemic. But Robert, this is one of the things that I have appreciated the most about you in working with you, is that this is the way you seem to always work, because you've never missed a deadline. In fact, I can say this, you've never hit a deadline. You've always been ahead of the deadline for us. And that, for a person in my position, for instance, as your client, is huge, to be able to meet the date and the deadline that is needed. So I have to, you know, sound out an encouragement to those who want to do this work. Your work ethic is going to make such a difference in your ability to be able to support yourself.
There's no question that to get better at this thing we call arranging, you've got to do it. I mean, that's the reading. I hope a lot of young arrangers will want to read my book, but reading my book will not make you instantly a better arranger. What will make you a better arranger are two things. Consciously taking the time to listen and study other people's work. When I was getting started, I was really fortunate for the time, because Charlie Brown, who wrote Part the Waters, Lord, and several other big things, who was the chief editor at Word, Charlie and Kurt Kaiser both hired me as a copyist. And so I was studying their scores, the things they wrote for the recording studio for their choral books. These days, a young arranger, everything that's ever been published is readily available. You can buy a single copy online. You can buy the full orchestration and study it and get the demonstration recording. And what a great thing. And I didn't have that. I wish we had. So you need to listen intently. And then back to what you were saying, you just got to get at the piano and sit down and start putting notes on paper, and then test it out. Put it in front of a group of singers and hear them sing it and go, did that work or did it not work? You know, I recommend in the book that if you can find a lab choir, you know, some guinea pigs you can put your music in front of, and hear it, because nothing will teach you more faster than hearing what you wrote sung by real human beings. That you will instantly hear all your mistakes, and don't assume the problems are the singers, assume the problems are your notes, but you'll instantly hear all of that, and you can go about fixing it and learning from your mistakes. That's what makes you better. It's tough for the new arranger. You talked about making a living or earning money from this. It's really getting more and more difficult. First of all, choral music sales have plummeted, not just because of COVID, but honestly, because of the infestation of praise and worship music, which does not require much of a choir or anything at all. And I am really hoping that we are beginning to see the start of the pendulum swinging back toward choirs. But I was fortunate that I always had work that paid me to do this, whether it was writing jingles for Taco Bueno for a vocal group, you know, in the recording studio, or I began writing speculative arrangements and submitting them to publishers. There was a greater need for things back then. It's tougher for a new person to get started. And so that's why I think having a lab choir is so important, to be able to put your music in front of somebody and hear it. And I think the other thing is that we need to be doing this because we love it more than anything else. And, you know, your own stuff, the things you were talking about, those introits and exits and the little pieces that you've written, those are, if there's a new arranger out there, those are great ways to test your skills. You know, I used to say as a songwriter, I was going, you know, writing jingles was one of the great educations for me, because if you can write a song that fits in 60 seconds, you know how to write a song. And and if you can write a piece of choral music that is one sentence or 45 seconds and it makes sense, then writing a bigger thing it's all the same principles are packed into that 45 seconds. A good start, a good finish, good part writing. You know, I hammer on the point in this book that part writing really does make a difference. It is huge. A good part writing is what makes the difference in an average choir being able to readily sing something or stumbling and fumbling through it. You know, and even professional singers, good part writing makes all the difference in the world. You know, it's just so important. And so I know that it's boring to hear that for those of us who sat in music theory classes, you know, I don't want to talk about part writing, but part writing is crucial, truly crucial for the choral arranger.
And when you get in front of your own choir and stuff either falls apart or really sounds good, then you begin to see, oh, yeah, that's the difference that it makes. It's interesting, on my little 45-second introits that I have created, so many of those things, when I put them in front of my choir the first time, I can tell you within 6 seconds if this piece is going to work or not. I mean, it's like it's so informative and it's so educational to write something and put it out there and let people sing it. You just learn immediately.
I was so lucky as a kid. I had a high school, the choir director at our school was also the choir director at my church.
A
fellow named Wayne Doyle. And Wayne was a fine singer and well-educated, and he taught me how to conduct because he was trying to find a kid who could back him up when he couldn't be in the pulpit on Sunday night. He needed somebody who could lead the hymns. So I learned all my conducting patterns from Wayne. Then he taught a theory class at school, and I took it when I was a senior, which gave me a leg up as I headed to music school in college. But he also allowed me a handful of times to come to choir rehearsal with a piece of music and put it in front of the choir and let them sing it at my church. And then even with his ensemble, his pop ensemble at school. And for a 19-year-old kid to be able to put something in front of real people was a big, big deal. Now, I wasn't smart enough. Like you were saying, you could tell now in 6 seconds. I wasn't that astute back then, you know.
Well, it's just experience.
Exactly. I honestly can look at a piece now, almost just look at it on the page and go, this isn't going to happen, or it will. You know? And I mean, I was sitting in a church choir not too long ago, and a published piece. It was kind of lovely, but it had this just horrible leaps for the men that made no sense. And I hate doing this because it's being a choir member. The choir director doesn't necessarily want an arranger sitting there saying, you know, but I finally raised my hand. I said, I think I can fix this by just literally changing one note, that we're having to jump up when we need. The voice leading was really awkward. And,
right.
And I'm going, so don't assume that if you're singing from printed music that all the voice leading is brilliant.
Right, right.
You know, if you want to see brilliant voice leading, study, I mean, look at anything John Purifoy does. His voice leading is always impeccable. Cindy Berry's voice leading, always impeccable. They never, never miss a step. And it's like people like that, those are arrangers who really care about the choir, you know?
Right, right. Robert Sterling, I love your book. And I think anybody who gets it and spends a little time with it is going to love it. Go to robertsterlingmusic.com. That's where all of his materials are found. And thank you for joining us again on this side of the microphone. We'll be hearing you more and more as time goes on one side of the microphone or the other.
Principles of Choral Arranging by Robert Sterling can be purchased at robertsterlingmusic.com. You'll find it under the Books tab on the website's homepage. QCast is the podcast of Youth Cube, creating soundtracks for life since 1990. Executive producer, Randy Edwards. Producer and theme music, Robert Sterling. Online publishers, Colin Witt and Preston Edwards. I'm Cindy Sterling, today's host. We'll see you next time on QCast.